Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I have Amanda Kadlik, and she is a RAND analyst focusing on the Middle East and North Africa, and we are discussing the U.S.'s Africa policy. So the reason we wanted to have this show and have shows on Africa is because it's something that doesn't receive a lot of attention. I think a few months ago when we had that incident with special operations soldiers in North Africa and Niger, it was kind of shocking to me that on Twitter, like regular people on Twitter were sort of shocked that, oh, we have soldiers in North Africa, we have this huge presence. And then when you dig deeper, it's a very complex and nuanced policy. And in addition to the U.S.'s policy, we also will be thinking about sort of the great power politics, so-called great power politics that surround the continent that involve China, Russia, France, and sort of, you know, how they behave in relation to the United States. So please welcome Amanda Kadlik for me. I want to start off with a very basic question, and that is, give us an overview of what you consider and what you think of U.S. policy to be towards Africa. Is it, you know, I think I'm sort of creating the same, like a typical mistake, but, you know, Africa is this broad continent, and, you know, when it comes up in policy, how is it dealt with?
Good question. Like you said, Africa is a continent, so the only thing that I feel comfortable speaking to is policy on North Africa. And even within the United States government, with the between the different agencies, there's each agency approaches it in a different way. So the DoD, for example, considers Egypt as part of the Middle East CENTCOM region, and State Department sees it as all of North Africa plus the Middle East region. So every agency sees it, identifies North Africa, even just North Africa, in different terms. But there's, and for the DoD, it's all of it's just AFRICOM Africa. So North Africa for the State Department is part of the Middle East, and for the DoD, all of North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa are one thing. So, you know, that makes things interesting, I guess, just in terms of how the U.S. government is split on how to define Africa. In terms of policy, you know, before we started recording, you had asked me what the difference is between the Obama administration and the Trump administration in terms of Africa policy. With regard to North Africa, which is, you know, I can't speak to Sub-Saharan Africa so much, but with regard to North Africa, it's, you know, we're only 1 year into the Trump administration, so it's still a little bit difficult to see or, you know, to be able to discern what the Trump administration is seeking to accomplish in Africa, in North Africa. For the moment, it doesn't really seem that much different, given the policy directives that the Obama administration put in place and the ones that are still in place that the Trump administration is piggybacking off of. So does that answer your question, at least the first part of it, I hope?
Yeah. So I wonder, maybe we can zoom in on North Africa and sort of, you know, do we consider that, you know, let's start off with a basic question again. You know, what are the sort of, you know, core set of problems, you know, in this region? You know, I think off the top of my head, it's, you know, migration into Europe, sort of state building in Libya, and sort of, you know, the results of the Arab Spring in Tunisia. So when it comes to this region, you know, how do we, you know, what is the core set of problems that we should be thinking about?
So up to now, well, there are two ways to look at this. There's the country by country way of looking at it, and then the issue way of looking at it. So on the country level, we've got Libya, where we have, you know, which essentially has been a civil war. It's been a low-level civil war. It's not, you know, it's been isolated to certain areas, you know, intense fighting, but it, in my opinion, qualifies as a civil war. So there's been a civil war there for almost 4 years now. No political resolution in sight. I mean, elections are coming up, but those might make things worse than better. So there's the Libya, at this country level, Libya is an issue. Then Tunisia with, I don't know if you've been following, for the last week there were, there was a show of protests and then a show of force by security services, arresting journalists and cracking down. And that, I think, sent fear, I guess, or concern, you know, but overdue concern that, you know, Tunisia isn't the shining star success story that everyone thought it was or would be. But that's, you know, open for debate. So there's the Libya at state level, Tunisia at the state level. Then if we want to look at Egypt, which is, you know, technically part of CENTCOM, but part of the State Department's view of North Africa and the Middle East, Egypt is not doing well. And there's, you know, the leadership under Sisi, I think we're all very familiar, is taking a turn for the worse and for, you know, toward a darker side. And then Algeria, looking at the country level, and this is also open for debate. Some scholars will say it's stable. Some will say it's imploding from within at a very slow but steady pace. And then there's Mali, Niger, Chad, the poorer Sahel countries. Mali, the government, is not in control. Niger, as we know, not particularly stable, but more stable than its neighbor. And Chad, also considered to be stable, but the president there has been in power for 25 years. He's getting up in age, and eventually there will be some kind of transition of power that might not necessarily be stable, that could create knock-on effects or second and third-order effects following his departure. So at the country level, things are not looking good. And then, you know, at the state political level and economic level, poverty is certainly still very persistent across the region. And then there are the issues, like you mentioned. So at the issue level, there's mass migration, there is weapons and drug trade, there is economic stagnation, there is, you know, violence, and civil war or conflict, and no matter where you look. Boko Haram, jihadist actors like Boko Haram and others. So there are all of these issues that are outstanding or salient in the region that the U.S. and European actors are trying to mitigate. And then at the state level, that's usually or typically historically is how we've looked at these issues, is we'll say, okay, well, there are these problems in Niger, so let's create a policy that focuses on Niger, or a policy that focuses on Mali. That started to change around the mid-2000s the early 2000s when the United States implemented the Pan-Sahel Initiative, which then later became the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership. After the fall of, the problems that Mali had in 2012 and 2013 with a takeover by jihadist actors in the north, once that happened, the French got on that bandwagon, like the Sahel region bandwagon, I guess you could say, and sought to create the G5 Sahel Force, which is, it sort of conceptually falls along the same lines of having a regional initiative in addition to the sort of state level policy directives.
Interesting. So then, you know, to circle back, when we think about the State Department and DOD, mm-hmm. are they on the same page when it comes to policy, or is it, you know, DOD tends to view this region through the lens of counterterrorism and CVE, whereas the State Department would view it through I guess, diplomacy, democracy promotion, aid, or, is DOD and Department of State sort of working in tandem and hand in hand together?
There's definitely a tendency for, the Department of Defense to focus more on hard security objectives, but with regard to North Africa, the State Department is very much involved in counterterrorism efforts there and countering violent extremism programs, and countering violent extremism messaging, those kinds of, I guess, what would fall into the softer category. But no, the DOD and state work together on, with specifically with regard to the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership. They work together and share funding streams, so they have to work together on those things. But even though there's usually part of the TSCTP is, the idea was to create a whole of government approach to security cooperation in the region, which included things like democracy promotion and, messaging campaigns and things like that, economic development. And those things are all well and good, and conceptually it is absolutely the right way to go. The problem is it's the impact of those things is difficult to measure. And usually, back at home in U.S. government, the powers that be want to know what kind of impact the spending of those funds is getting. And the problem is, with whole of government approach to security cooperation, the effects of those things might not be visible for a couple of decades. So sometimes, after thing, projects or programs have been implemented, it's not possible to see after those 3 or 4 years of whole of government approach if it's actually been successful or not. In some cases, there has been shown that certain programs and initiatives are effective. But the concept of the whole of government approach to security cooperation usually is eclipsed by the harder or the tension toward and focus toward these more hard security cooperation objectives, like training forces, flintlock exercises, any kind of military training, intelligence cooperation, and all those things. It's ideally and conceptually, over the past 10 years, that has actually been sort of a breakthrough in how we see security cooperation, but it has always sort of defaulted back to the harder security stuff.
So then, when we talk about security cooperation and security assistance, what are we specifically talking about? Is it a matter of training and assist? Is it a matter of loaning or using more technical intelligence methods, drones, satellites, whatever is obviously not available to the host nation? How are we defining this? Because I think when the Niger story broke, it seemed like the characterization, at least the public characterization, was these operators, these special forces soldiers, were in the field, and it not only were they training, but it seemed like they were actively involved in operations, in shooting, to maybe use a simplified verb here. But I mean, how do we characterize this cooperation?
That gets tricky because I don't know. I don't have the kind of information that some people do, and it's a sensitive topic right now. And I don't think that the Department of Defense has come out with any kind of concrete, definitive statement as to what has happened. They're still investigating, so I can't really comment on that part. But there definitely is concern that. And this has been a running concern with programs like the TSCTP and others, that the forces that we're seeking to train or trying to train don't have the absorptive capacity to be able to benefit from the training, or they don't have the absorptive capacity to be even. So it's sort of like if the United States gives Niger, the Niger Special Forces or Niger military weapons or training, will they even be able to use it in a way that the United States hopes it will? So, you know, Niger could be an example. Let's use another example like Chad. We could say, well, we're training Chad's special force, but is, you know, another problem that comes along with that is human rights. So we might be training Chad's special forces, but is it inflicting, pain and terror on Chad's people, on the people of Chad? So, that's another issue. I sort of got off track there, but what I'm trying to get at is that with the funding that the United States gives North African countries to be able to, let me put it another way. The idea of these kinds of training mechanisms is that the force that we're training will be able to carry out the mission that we want it to, which includes all kinds of things. It includes actually going out into the field and doing the things that we wanted to do on hard security measures, and by adhering to human rights standards, and by spending money in a way that we hope that they would spend it in a transparent way. There's a whole bucket of expectations that the United States has of these different countries and the governments that run their militaries. There has been a persistent concern since the arrival of these kinds of programs like the TSCTP that those outcomes are not, those expectations aren't reasonable, that they're not realistic. So I think that with what happened in Niger, there is absolutely concern that, and depending on how the story ends up coming out, and with particularly with regard to the conflicting accounts of what actually happened, you know, it's a totally reasonable concern that the training that we're giving or the weapons that we're offering, the whole comprehensive package, isn't going to actually deliver what the United States hopes it will, and that, you know, the U.S. soldiers will end up having to do the work, you know, in lieu of their inability to do so.
So then I want to maybe take a step back and look at the region, and then specifically, like, how do we, when we think about this region, how do we work in other nation states? So, for instance, I think we've already touched on France, but how do we work in Russia? And then I think the most famous sort of example is China. I think it's almost China and Africa almost seems to be a meme at this point. But so sort of how do we work in these other sort of, you know, larger powers into North Africa policy?
Ooh, that is a really big question, and I can't answer that. I would need some time to prepare in terms of, because I don't know China policy. I know tangentially some things about Russia because of its increased involvement in North Africa, but with regard to how we, you know, work in a broader policy to include Russia and China and Africa, I can't answer that at the moment. Sorry.
No, it's all right. How do we work in France then? I mean, you've already touched on sort of France's involvement in the Sahel. I mean, do we consider France to be, you know, sort of a constructive partner that has the similar goals to the United States, or do we just sort of consider them to be self-interested and sort of any initiative it takes is really for its own gain as opposed to working with the United States?
So the relationship between France and the United States has been, it's been at some times strained and at other times cooperative. Up to and through the 1990s, France was by far the one foreign power in North Africa that dominated. Algeria, just to France, the South was once a part of France. It wasn't just a colony, it was part of France. So France has its, you know, for lag, and I think I've mentioned this before when, you know, in other conversations with you, that so France sort of still sees North Africa as its backyard. So, for example, to sort of, you know, demonstrate this one example of the strain between the United States and France and in North Africa, Chad, before Idriss Déby, Abré was in power and was very close to the United States. And it, the rumor has it is that, so France has had a permanent base in Chad for 30, 40 years, and has its forces there apparently stood aside as Abré was overthrown because they didn't like that the United States was so close to Abré and had him under so much influence. So that's one example. Another example, well, so that's one example of how where they differed. One example where they were sort of in line with one another was in Algeria during the 1990s and the Civil War. The United States kind of just took a step back and allowed France to really take the lead and on diplomatic efforts and other initiatives to try to quell the Civil War, even though at one point they also, both of them, encouraged democratic governance and a democratic opening in Algeria. Another point where the US and France have cooperated was with Operation Serval in 2012, 2013. To rout jihadists from northern Mali. So they have at times worked together and have at times not worked so well together. At the moment, so the, well, and then there's also Libya. So the French and the Brits in 2011 drove the initiative to you know, get a UN Security Council resolution that would intervene in the Libya conflict for humanitarian purposes. At least that was the rationale given at the time. And so the United States supported France and Britain, and, or, you know, with the term that I think got coined, but as Obama having said, but I don't know that he actually said it, but the leading from behind concept that you know the Europeans and the French, you know the French in particular, were going to lead this effort toward intervention in Libya, but that the United States was going to support France and Britain in that effort. So now, after Serval and now Operation Barkhane, which is the subsequent military mission in Mali that actually stretches, you know, across the Sahara region. The G5 Sahel initiative is being led by France, now has, you know, UN Security Council support, and the US is supporting it. Gulf actors are supporting it, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So these are all these great, you know, the great powers that want to sort of have influence in North Africa. The one, actually, the one reason I didn't really get into, I think, why I don't focus on Russia and China in this part of the world is because I think the bigger actors are the actors who more have more resources and more interest in driving political outcomes are Gulf actors actually than would be Russia or China. Not to say that Russia and China aren't involved, but from my perspective, Russia, China seems far more interested in you know securing minerals and then and you know building projects and creating positive relationships with governments for that sole purpose, not for political power to have any kind of political influence. Gulf actors like you know United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, they're actually interested in having political influence and power for the sake of that. And not to say that there aren't other reasons too, but to get back to your question about working in France, the United States is supportive of the G5 Sahel initiative. I'm sorry, yeah, sorry, the G5 Sahel initiative and the joint force. So, you know, well, I think it remains to be seen what is going to come of the G5. It's still a bit experimental. It's only a few years old, even in concept. So it really remains to be seen how much impact it's actually going to have and what the U.S. role in that will be. But there is, they're clearly working together and cooperating on it.
Interesting. So I want to maybe go back and sort of explore. You mentioned the GCC in North Africa. So is it, when we talk about GCC involvement in North Africa, I mean, do we consider, because we had that sort of diplomatic spat at towards the end of 2017, beginning of 2018 between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. So when we examine GCC policy towards North Africa, is it a reflection of the GCC, or is it more of a reflection of the individual players and actors within that organization?
It's definitely more reflective of the individual players. Like you mentioned, after the split between Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, there hasn't been much movement back toward resolving that conflict or resolving that split. The big argument or the main reason given by Saudi Arabia and the UAE is that Qatar has been a sponsor of state terrorism, or a state sponsor of terrorism in the region, and that is could be true, with regard to North Africa, so it's just to sort of exemplify that how that has actually played out in Libya. On the eastern side of the country, there's a general named, or now Field Marshal, Khalifa Haftar. He is backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, militarily, financially, and also Egypt as well. On the other side of the country, there's a government in Tripoli that the Saudis and the Emiratis will say is supported by Qatar. So there is a rift within Libya clear rift between who the Saudis and the Emiratis support and who the Qataris allegedly support. So in that respect, it's actually playing out by these individual actors in North Africa. It's definitely not the GCC as a whole. The GCC as a whole, I think, is a bit of a, it's kind of like a myth. It's not really a thing. I mean, it is a thing in terms of an organization, but the way the different countries within the GCC operate there's variety. I mean, it's not a monolith organization. So, But I guess what I would say is that particularly Qatar, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia are interested in influencing political outcomes in North Africa.
So, if we can, I want to maybe switch footing to examining sort of the Obama administration versus the Trump administration in terms of their involvement in Africa, because I think the Trump administration is about a year old, and yet you've made the point earlier in the conversation that it doesn't seem like they're, you know, radically changing U.S. policy towards Africa. So I'm sort of curious if we can sort of dig deeper into this, which is, you know, it's, you know, in a general sense, let's start here. In a general sense, how would you describe Trump's sort of view towards Africa? Is it really he's just sort of, you know, due to bureaucratic inertia, sort of, you know, implementing the Obama policies, or has he been, you know, radically changing it, or an attempt to radically change it, I should say?
No, I think you're spot on. A lot of it is bureaucratic inertia. The Pan-Sahel Initiative was started in 2002. The Bush administration, under the Bush administration, was heightened under the Bush administration in 2006. The Obama administration and AFRICOM was first begun under the Bush administration, carried on by the Obama administration. And so now we have a policy that's been not only set in place, but developing over time. The main reason that the TSCTP was initiated in the first place was because of the perceived threat of terrorist actors in North Africa. And that was all formed around the global war on terror. Like that was the impetus for it. So, and it's carried on. So it's, the program and the policy directives under the Obama administration that were in place when he left for the Trump administration, I think still makes sense. I mean, there are parts of it that the Trump administration might not want to follow through with, like economic development projects and, the democracy promotion aspects of it. But, I mean, there are plenty of people in the Obama administration who didn't want to follow through with democracy promotion objectives either. I think it's very much a case of bureaucratic inertia, but it's also helpful to the Trump administration if the message that the administration wants to give is that it's hard on security or hard on jihadist actors or is, focused on counterterrorism objectives, all of the pieces are already in place for the administration to just carry on with. And that was all put in place by the Bush administration and carried on by the Obama administration. So I with everything else, migration, and I mean, there are things that the Trump administration has already shown that where it has parted, and the first one is creating a travel ban on Chad, which most North Africa specialists would sort of like raise an eyebrow at and wonder why, because it is a key security partner. So there's that. And then, on the diplomatic level in Libya, the Obama administration was very concerned about maintaining a diplomatic presence and had a special envoy for Libya, for example, Jonathan Weiner. And now that role has been completely eliminated. And President Trump made clear that, at least publicly, that there is no interest at all in maintaining any kind of role in Libya apart from fighting ISIS. So there are definite splits, but on most concrete measures, not much has changed.
So, I mean, is it fair to characterize, it seems like at the bureaucratic level, at the, Department of State, DOD, it's just a continuation of policy that was started by the Bush administration, continued by Obama, and then continued by this administration. But at the same time, like, it seems like there's a lot of, like, I wouldn't say confusion, but chaos in coming out of the executive offices. I think you've already mentioned sort of including Chad on the travel ban, but also sort of this emphasizing sort of the military part and de-emphasizing the diplomacy and engagement part. I mean, is that a fair characterization, or is there a little more nuance to how the Trump administration is engaging Africa or North Africa? Excuse me.
No, I think that would be a pretty fair assessment. That there is far less interest, and it's visible, in terms of concrete output, that the Trump administration is less interested in diplomatic engagement than the Obama administration. I mean, just generally speaking, not just with North Africa, the most of the positions in the State Department have yet to be filled. There's a, what some would consider to be an active culling of the State Department and its capacities. Excuse me. More of these rhetorical statements with increased focus on counterterrorism and defeating ISIS and things like that. But, it's not hard to back up those, sort of rhetorical statements with actual impact. It's because of the policies that we already have in place from the previous two administrations. So I would say you could almost say that the Trump administration is actually in a very good position to further its objectives to implement counterterrorism measures or, focus on hard security because of the elements that have been put in place already for it. Not to say that, decreasing diplomatic engagement, and, this is from an objective policy standpoint or from a policy analyst standpoint, I would say that having, disproportionate focus on counterterrorism objectives or hard security measures at the expense of diplomatic engagement is never good, because you have to have some sort of relationship or positive relationship with the governments and the people you're working with. And actually, just as I know, I'm getting off topic here just slightly, but with any of these initiatives in North Africa, like the G5 or the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, I think the big thing that these programs are missing is that so much of what is determined in North Africa is at a very local level. And if trust, and I'm tight, like it really has to be a genuine level of trust. If forces or diplomats or economic development, people go into these different small towns and villages, if they're not able to build trust with local people, a militant armed group is, you can throw as much money and as many weapons as you want and as much training of special security or special forces of these governments as you want. It's not going to do any, it's not going to solve the problem, and could actually end up making the situation worse and actually empowering the militant groups that they want to eliminate.
Interesting.
So sorry, off topic there, but it was sort of something that I wanted to touch on earlier that I skipped over, and yeah.
Well, then I want to maybe, draw a circle around that. And, when Chad is included on the travel ban, I mean, has that, as a layman, obviously that's, you kind of shrug your shoulders, but as a sort of policy analyst, how do you look at that? I mean, Chad's inclusion on the travel ban, has that sort of damaged the relationship? Or is it sort of recognized as, it's just, bluster? What is the perception of being included on the travel ban from the perspective of cooperation with the government of Chad?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely harmed it. I can't remember exactly, but there was something that happened within a month or two, maybe even sooner after the travel ban was implemented, that the Chadian government had retaliated in some way. I can't remember the specifics of it, but from my perspective, it was just so confusing. It didn't really make any sense to me, but then again, there's always a possibility that there's some sort of like high level intelligence that they have that I don't. But you would think that there would be other steps taken before doing something like that, if there were a threat, because Chad, during Operation Serval, and granted this was led by the French, but this French effort was directly in line with what with U.S. interests in the region. The U.S. was supportive of it, of the operation as well. Chad was absolutely pivotal to making that operation happen. I don't know that the operation would have had the kind of success that it did if Chad hadn't been involved. They sent a couple thousand soldiers, I believe, across the desert on motorcycles, within a few days' time, to be able to support the mission. So, I still can't understand it. I can't understand why that decision was made. But you would think that, at least I would think that, before taking an action like that, it might be useful to talk with the Chadian government or at least not rely on it as a security partner. I mean, those two things are in contradiction with one another. We're relying on them as a security partner. And by the way, you can't come to our country. I would think it would be more targeted. I wish I had an answer. I don't. It's confusing. No.
So I think we've sort of come to the end of the interview, and as always, we always like to ask our guests, leave us with something to think about, to chew on, to sort of pore over while, until the next show, right? So just
Yeah.
leave us with something to think about.
Something to think about. With regard to North Africa or just about anything?
Preferably North Africa, but I mean, it's up to the interviewee,
It's North Africa. I guess the thing that I would look out for is two things, actually, two things to chew on. One would be Algeria to see what's going to happen this year. Abdelaziz Bouteflika is getting a bit older, and he is not well. So things are sort of happening in Algeria. That's the one this year, I would say. Look at Algeria and what might happen. And the other one would be Libya's elections. Those are supposed to be coming up in June, July, August time frame, sometime this summer. To keep an eye on that, and to maybe be a little bit more, what I say, like cautious about the positive impact that some people think that those elections will have.
Awesome. Thank you so
Yeah.
much for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you very much.